Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. The finest rock songwriter after Dylan and the best electric guitarist since Hendrix. That's how the Los Angeles Times describes Richard Thompson. I'm certainly not going to argue with that. I would add that he also has a beautiful and very powerful singing voice. Richard was a vital part of the late 60s folk scene in England as a valuable member of Fairport Convention. He also recorded 6 albums with his then-wife, Linda Thompson. Richard recently released a memoir called B-Swing, Losing My Way and Finding My Voice, 1967 to 1975, which he wrote with Scott Timberg. Beta's own Steve Gotcher sat down with Richard to talk about the early years of his career and why the book is called B-Swing.
B-Swing is the title of a song, and it's a song of mine that, to my mind, encapsulates some of the things I felt about the 1960s and into the 1970s. So it seemed good thematically to be a title for the book. It's about people really dropping out, people not taking the path well-traveled, people not going into the family business, people not getting jobs in banks and accountancy firms, but people really not going to university, dropping out, becoming drug dealers, becoming drug addicts in some cases, you know, joining communes, all that kind of thing. Taking to the road as well, you know, becoming itinerant. And I thought, you know, the song is a bit like that as well. It's about people really falling through the safety net almost of society. So I thought it was a good reflection of the book.
I understand that you have your guitar handy. Is that true?
It could be true if I lean backwards. Yes. What can I do for you in that sense?
Well, I was told that you would play a little bit of B-Swing for us.
Oh, okay. Okay. I was 19 when I came to town. They caught the summer of love. They were burning babies, burning flags, the hawks against the doors. I took a job in the steamy down on Cardram Street. I fell in love with a laundry girl who was working next to me. Oh, she was a rare thing, fine as a bee's wing. So fine, a breath of wind might blow her away. She was a lost child, she was running wild. She said, as long as there's no price on love, I'll stay. And you wouldn't want me any other way. Etc.
Excellent. Thank you very much. How did the guitar become your instrument of choice?
When I was growing up, it was all guitars, you know. First of all, my father had really good guitar records. He had Les Paul records, he had Django Reinhardt records, he had Lonnie Johnson records, of all things. And so I had that from that end of the spectrum. And then my sister, my big sister, was buying rock and roll records when I was still quite young. So I was hearing Elvis and hearing, Buddy Holly, a lot of Buddy Holly. The guitar seemed like something that I should do myself, you know. It's this very sexy thing, so I thought I should get a guitar. And I started pestering my parents from probably about the age of 6, actually. And they fobbed me off with toys, really, until a real one appeared in the house when I was about 10. And then I kind of took to it like a duck to water and took classical lessons and then just played by ear and got an electric guitar when I was probably about 12. And took it from there.
You know, you talk a lot about other musical styles. You talked about your father's music. You talked about the rock and roll that your sister played for you. You have a lot of musical influences that you've worked very hard to incorporate into the music that you do. Now, a lot of musicians lock into a particular type like pop or metal and stay with that style. But why do you think that it was necessary to try to blend styles?
I'm not sure it was a conscious thing. I just love certain kinds of music. I love jazz from all eras. You know, so starting with my father's records, I heard some of that, and then I got into, you know, Coltrane, Albert Ayler, people like that. I love classical music, mostly 20th century stuff. And, you know, I love what you call roots music. And I grew up with, you know, Celtic music, listening to that. And somehow it all kind of worked in together. And I realized, you know, when I was playing electric guitar as a teenager, bits of all that stuff were creeping in without me really thinking about it.
Is the blending of styles something you're still striving for in the music that you're doing today?
I think I have a style now. I think it's established. And when you have a style, you can bring in other things to it. And you don't sound like you're a, you know, a musical colonialist or a dilettante. You know, it becomes you. But
right.
you can be inspired by things from outside your genre, I think, all the time. And that's a wonderful thing. I mean, that's happened across the whole history of music, really.
Now, your book covers a specific period, and I was curious why you picked 1967 to 1975, but once I finished the book, I realized it was a pivotal period for you. After that, you kind of got yourself set on a course. Is that an accurate description?
Yeah, I suppose so. 67 was the year that my band Fairport Convention turned professional. And, you know, that was a big step forward. And then it was really lots of things happening to us very quickly. We were getting lots of work immediately, making records very quickly. And it was a time, one of those times in music, a bit like the punk era or something, like when the floodgates open and lots of bands get signed up because the record industry doesn't quite understand what's going on and is struggling to catch up. So they tend to sign everything. And we were very fortunate in that way that we kind of rode in on this wave of psychedelia, even though we were not a psychedelic band. You know, we rode in at the same time as Pink Floyd and the Soft Machine and, you know, the Crazy World of Arthur Brown and The Move and lots of other bands at that time.
Yeah, it seems like Fairport Convention and that time, you were like a subculture of a subculture.
I think we were a subculture of a subculture of a subculture.
Okay.
I go even further. Yes, you could say that. I mean, we were coming through at a time when lots of music was accepted, though. So we weren't a blues band. There were lots of blues bands around at that time. We weren't a psychedelic band necessarily. Lots of that going on at the time. But, you know, the audience would accept you as they would accept the Incredible String Band, or they would accept, you know, Duster Bennett or Ivor Cutler, you know, more eccentric people as part of the whole picture. And they'd sit and listen to you and they'd applaud you. It was very egalitarian. It was very open, really. Perhaps an even an unusual time in music.
Yeah, and you say in the book that you didn't really catch on in a huge way, but you wanted to stay true to the music that you wanted to play, and you did that. And you didn't compromise, it seems, ever, even to this day.
I think that's a fair assessment. Well, we were always determined as a band to be different, to be individual. And we loved roots music, so we were always reflecting our interest in that. And we loved lyrics. We loved the great songwriters. Well, we loved Phil Oakes and we loved Bob Dylan and we loved Leonard Cohen and Joni Mitchell. So in our early incarnations, before we really started writing, we would cover, you know, these singer-songwriters.
Suzanne takes you down to a place by the river. You can hear the boats go by. You can spend
And you know, when the birds started doing Dylan songs or something, that was a real inspiration for us. And ultimately, when we started writing our own music, then that became a whole other thing.
A very amazing thing happened when, just before your second album, Sandy Denny joined your band. How did she change the band's sound? What was her contribution?
She was a fantastic singer. So right at the front of the band, yeah, you had someone who was so good that you couldn't help but play better. You couldn't help but be elevated by her skill as a singer. She was a wonderful singer, but just wonderful communicator of a song to an audience. And when Sandy joined the band, she had been playing in folk clubs, and we thought that because we didn't have a lot of rehearsal time, we kind of molded ourselves around some of Sandy's acoustic arrangements, and some of those were traditional songs. And this started us on a whole quest, really, to blend more British traditional music with contemporary instruments, with electric instruments. And that started us off, you know, on our mission, if you like.
My young love said to me, my mother, mine, and my father won't slight you for your lack of kind.
On the album Unhalfbricking, you guys did a song that turned out to be 11 minutes long called A Sailor's Tale. And in the book you say you recorded that in one take. And it's one of the most compelling pieces on the album. How did the process of getting it in one take happen?
This was a song that Sandy knew. So Sandy had been singing it in folk clubs. It's called A Sailor's Life. And we did it live, like, I think twice. Really just jamming, you know, in that real 60s style, you know. So we start out singing the song and it goes through five or six verses, and then we play a kind of instrumental long passage at the end of it. We thought we should record it, and so we got Dave Swarbrick in, a wonderful traditional fiddler, and we just said, really, okay, this is what we're going to do. We're going to start out of time, then we're going to kick into tempo and play this instrumental passage, and then see you at the end, basically. And that was about it in terms of preparation. And, you know, we just played it once and it sounded really good. And we thought, well, that's it. There's no point doing it again. I think we've absolutely cracked it. And it was just a lucky performance, really.
1972 was a turning point for you. You left Fairport Convention, and you recorded your first solo album, the critically acclaimed Henry the Human Fly, and you met and married Linda Peters, and together you recorded six albums. Is there any one in particular that you're most proud of?
Well, I think the first one, I Want to See the Bright Lights Tonight, is probably the best one. Just in terms of songs, I think it has a really good selection of songs. Some of those songs I still sing to this day. And I think it was one of those records, again, it's a lucky record. It got recorded very quickly. I think we recorded it in 3 days. Everything went to plan. It's very unusual on a record. And yeah. I think it cost the princely sum of £2,500 to record, which is, you know, unheard of, really, you know, including all the musicians' fees, overdubs, and all that kind of stuff. Because of the way it was recorded, because of the lack of tricks on the record, you know, the lack of sort of trendy compression or phasing or flanging or anything, it sounds good today, you know. It hasn't dated too much.
I'm so tired of working.
Eventually, you came to embrace Islam, and you wrote, "It's like coming home after a long journey, that this is who you had always been." And then Linda embraced Islam a few months later. How did Islam change your lives?
Pretty drastically, I should say. I think you just acknowledge certain things about yourself, and you acknowledge some connection with, you know, the, whatever you want to call it, like the great spirit or the universe or something, and you affirm that connection. But in doing that, you lose some friends sometimes. You know, I realized, you know, when I stopped drinking, which I did like almost immediately, that some people you'd never really spent time with sober, and you didn't really like them. So some friends fell by the wayside. I'm sure that we irritated a lot of people, you know, being kind of, you know, newly different, if you like. So it's a transitional period, really, the first couple of years. But then I think we've kind of figured out how to interact with our old friends a bit better. And it became just an everyday thing.
The last album that you and Linda recorded together was Shoot Out the Lights, and it was released in 1982. It features one of your most powerful songs called Wall of Death. What can you tell me about that song?
So the Wall of Death, it's a motorcycle ride, you know, where you start off vertical and you end up horizontal on the motorcycle. The song also mentions other fairground rides. There was a famous seaside fairground, and all the rides were in this particular fairground. So it's a kind of a nod to that particular place, and I think almost to another era, so kind of 1950s era. But for me, it's a song about taking risks, and you could almost say it's a memo to myself when I sing that song, is don't hold back, take risks. This is music. You can't play safe in music.
Let me ride on the wall of death one more time. Let me ride on the wall of death one more time. You can waste your time on the other rides. This is the nearest to being alive. Oh, let me take my chances on the wall of death.
I wanted to circle back and ask you a question about the end of your book. You ended your book talking about Sandy Denny and the tragedy of her last few years. Why did you want to end the book there?
Well, the book's really concerned about the years 67 to 75, and everything after that is really an afterword. It's really just trying to tie up loose ends for the reader, really. And I thought it was important to say that Sandy, you know, deteriorated after that time and died, you know, at the age of 31. I thought it was important to say that. I said about Nick Drake as well, how young he died. Talk about, you know, the breakup of my marriage with Linda very briefly. Just so people had more of a complete picture without me having to write about the next few years necessarily, which I found mostly not that interesting to write about. So I stopped, I think, at the right time. I stopped in 75, and I just wanted to really catch up after that.
Richard Thompson, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Richard Thompson is the author of B-Swing, Losing My Way and Finding My Voice, 1967 to 1975. Steve Gotcher talked with him. You can find out more about Richard and the early years of his career at wpr.org/beta.
When the spell is broken.
There is a certain kind of reduction in the prose, like a sameness, where after you've read 1,100 pages of it, you feel like you drank 10 gallons of chocolate milk or something.
Author Rachel Kushner talks about Cormac McCarthy's Border Trilogy and some other subjects that she explores in her essay collection, The Hard Crowd. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.